the lot of the lawyer is to protect and act in the interests of the client you're acting for. That requires one to keep utmost in mind the rights of the client. And therefore, in conducting a, being involved in a tax audit, requires the solicitor or the barrister, the legal representative, to form a view about the strengths and weaknesses of the client's case, what the client's rights are in relation to the case. Can I say this about the pre-objection stage as a general observation? So far as the interaction with the ATO is concerned, for the legal practitioner, it's a process of persuasion. What the legal practitioner must do is do whatever's necessary to persuade the, and what I mean by persuade is satisfy, because you can't bully the ATO into anything, so you have to satisfy the ATO. You have to satisfy the ATO's concerns. And a major area, inevitably, is to prove a fact, which you do by, or can do by producing a contemporaneous document, by not producing it, and so on. But, so that's what I mean by persuasion, really, is satisfying in whatever way is necessary, persuading the commissioner in whatever way is necessary, to, in such a way that the commissioner becomes satisfied about the taxpayer's position. But if I go back to persuasion, there are two areas. First thing to do is to persuade the commissioner there is no dispute. And then if, after the investigation is conducted, there still remains a dispute, the next thing to do is then to persuade the commissioner that the dispute is to be resolved in a way that the legal representative is happy is an accurate reflection of the client's rights. So in this whole process of persuasion, because we haven't got to court, there are various techniques for the legal practitioner to consider. One, of course, is the obvious example of providing documents, which is predominantly what Keith was directing his observations to, coffee. There are then further steps within the audit process that will give rise to opportunities for a legal representative to add to the process of persuasion. The first is the ATO's practice of giving a position paper which sets out the ATO's view as to what the dispute is and what the commissioner's position on the dispute is. It's my, whether it's a practice or not, I've at least seen more often than not that the commissioner issues draft position papers and invites comments from taxpayers about draft position papers. Now, it's issued as a draft position paper for the sole reason that what the ATO is wanting to happen is to engage in a process of dialogue with the commissioner, with the taxpayer, and gives the taxpayer the opportunity, again, to persuade the commissioner to resolve the dispute in such a way that reflects, on the legal representative's view, the accurate rights of the taxpayer. But I just ask Bill, in relation to his experiences with dealing with draft position papers, how successful or otherwise that process of dialogue has been in relation to audit resolutions.
I must say I have a somewhat mixed feelings about position papers. I have been involved in matters where, following the preparation of a full response to a position paper, the commissioner accepted the position and the audit was closed. I have been involved in audits where, following the preparation of a response, all the commissioner did, they took the arguments that you came up with in the position paper and prepared sound responses to them and finalized their position paper as a result of it. So you think, well, am I helping them build their case in doing what I just did? There will be tactical maneuvers, of course, and there would be occasions when you have to evaluate your position as to what your response should be and how detailed it should be. But as Greg has pointed out, a position paper is a great opportunity for you to know what's going on in the commissioner's head. Prior to that, all you have is a series of exchanges where the tax office says something, you say something, and so on. It's the first time that the tax office actually tells you, this is what we think, this is why we think that way, and this is what we think we're going to do, like issue an assessment, make a declaration, and such like. When you read the position paper, it is important to look at the concerns that went on in the minds of the persons that drafted it. Are they factual or evidentiary? Are they legal or both, it might be. What a number of people tend to do in their responses is they focus on the law, you have very detailed legal arguments of cases and so on. I found that it's very rarely the case that the tax officers do not know the cases. Because they specialize in areas, they always know every case about that particular area. So it's very rare that you can come up with a case that completely says, well, you got to give up your position. The disputes are often factual and evidentiary. If the commissioner says, I am not satisfied that you're able to establish one thing or another, if it's documentary, and of course if the documents are not privileged, and even if they are privileged, you might consider waiving it in an appropriate case. You provide those documents, you might address the problem. In some instances, you may not have documents. It might be that you say in your response that you will need evidence from such and such a witness whose evidence will be, and then you make an assertion. Sometimes the tax office might come back and say, very well, we want a sworn statement from that person. Now, if you need to evaluate that very carefully, because whatever sworn statement is made, it will be put to that witness later on in any later proceedings. So you need to be very careful in the way you phrase it. If you want to prepare one, you literally have to prepare it as a witness statement or an affidavit that you intend to use if the matter proceeds. You have to prepare it very carefully, and I strongly recommend that counsel be involved in it. On balance, I think that it is worth giving that position papers very serious consideration and prepare the best reply that you can, because if the matter comes to conclusion at that point, of course, you could end up saving your client huge sums of money.
Wayne or Brockman, it'd be fair to say, wouldn't it, that responses to draft position papers are taken quite seriously and can be very useful for consideration by the ATO in ultimately determining whether and if so, what the dispute is?
Absolutely, Greg. Any dialogue and interaction with the taxpayers is essential for the ATO to assess our understanding of the facts and the law.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly been my experience that it's worthwhile putting time and effort into addressing draft position papers. There is a distinction between draft and final position papers, but even once a final position paper has been prepared and sent off to the taxpayer, in my experience, if it's accompanied with a request for, do you want to make a response, it's more often than not sensible to make a good response to the position paper, because the ATO's position is not always entrenched in stone. That's fair enough, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it's ever too late to comment on a position paper or the ATO's understanding of facts. It can happen at any stage, whether you're in court or the AAT or protection court.
There's another area of discourse arises in relation to Part 4A proceedings, and as you'll be aware, there's a panel set up by the ATO that reviews an auditor's recommendation that Part 4A be applied. It's fair to say that the primary purpose of the panel is there to ensure that the practices of the ATO are by and large applied consistently across the various disputes. It's not a review that's designed to provide an independent assessment as to whether Part 4A should or should not apply. However, taxpayers are invited as to whether to put a submission to the GAR panel, and if one participates in such a submission, knowing that the purpose of the panel is more to ensure consistency within the ATO rather than to provide an independent assessment, it also in many cases provides a very suitable forum for a taxpayer to put further facts to the ATO again. Michael's had some experience in GAR panel submissions. If I could just ask Michael to comment upon the advantages and disadvantages of taxpayers participating in GAR panel proceedings.
I think it's worth noting at the outset that there's a couple of different ways in which taxpayers can participate in GAR panel proceedings. One is that the Commissioner might give the taxpayer the option of providing written submissions, and I think invariably you'd have the chance to provide written submissions. The other is that on occasions the taxpayer will actually be invited to present in person at the GAR panel, and I think there are different considerations that you should take into account when deciding which of those options to pursue. Some of the disadvantages of participation in the GAR panel submission are similar to those that Bill was talking about in relation to preparing or to making submissions in relation to position papers. Mainly, you may be giving the ATO an opportunity to improve its case by reason of your submissions. Despite that, I think I agree with Bill. I think it's better to put your best foot forward and to make your strongest submissions at the earliest possible time, and I think that includes in relation to the GAR panel consideration. Perhaps the more difficult question to consider is whether it's worthwhile attending the GAR panel in person and bring the client along. The risk that you run if you do participate in person is that what's said in the GAR panel proceeding isn't privileged. So comments that the taxpayer's representatives and possibly the client themselves make in the GAR panel could be used in the hearing, if the matter goes on to a hearing. It could potentially be used in establishing, for example, whether there's a tax benefit. I'm not aware of any case where that's happened in practice, but something that's worth bearing in mind when you're preparing to participate. The other consideration that I know has influenced some practitioners is that there has been a view that it's very unlikely that the GAR panel will decide that that a Part 4A determination should not be made. I can say that I've been involved in one matter where that did in fact happen, and so it was certainly worth the client's while attending the GAR panel and bringing about that outcome. And I understand that on the weekend the Law Council workshop, Des Malani indicated that about 30% of matters do not proceed to a Part 4A determination as a result of the GAR panel intervention. So that suggests that there is a benefit. So, but whether you actually participate or not, I think, is another matter, because often, you know, it may be that the written submissions would be adequate. And the other thing to bear in mind is you need to make an assessment of the strength of the case. There may just not be sufficient benefit in attending in person and expending that amount of resources if the likelihood is that there will be a positive determination.
Yes, but the figure that was stated, of course it's hearsay, so one shouldn't be too confident about it, but was that 3 out of 10 cases did not proceed as a result of GAR panel recommendations. So that's quite a significant percentage. And the other thing to bear in mind is that of the other 7 out of 10 cases that did proceed, not all of them proceeded upon all of the Part 4A issues. So that one can make use of the, potentially anyway, of the GAR panel procedure to reduce the issues involved. It might be simply a matter of knocking out some of the tax benefits. And there is some distinct, would be some distinct advantages involved in that, if that could also be achieved. Along that line, the Commissioner is now, as I said earlier, concerned to identify quite early on the issues in dispute and then to try and resolve them. And if informal dialogue hasn't been able to resolve in the resolution of issues, there are now a variety of accepted alternative dispute resolution techniques, such as early neutral evaluation proceedings, mediations, that can be adopted, and usefully so, where the taxpayer and the Commissioner will get together and see whether or not each side's case can be compromised to achieve a settlement. Lisa's had first-hand experience in a number of these ADRs, and I'll just ask her to comment upon the conduct and usefulness of those procedures at a pre-objection stage.
I think ADR is becoming more popular because there's a recognition on both sides, both taxpayers and the tax office, that positions are not always certain. There's no guarantee of success in a court, and not all disputes are suitable for resolution by court, particularly those where what's in dispute is not just going to affect 1 or 2 years of income, but ongoing. So a court looking at a particular set of facts may not necessarily give you the certainty and the ability to move on and get on with really what taxpayers need to do, which is get on with their business, and the tax office needs to have certainty about its revenue collection, with the principles that it's applying, and fairness across taxpayers generally. So ADR has come to the fore, and the tax office, particularly more recently, has taken ADR very seriously. It is a real option now, and some of the ways ADR comes into force is early neutral evaluations, where perhaps there's uncertainty about the principle underlying a dispute, and both parties sometimes become entrenched in their views, particularly if the dispute's been going on for quite some time. An early neutral evaluation allows an objective third party to come in, evaluate both sides of the argument, and it's not binding on either party, but it gives a chance for both parties to get an insight into how an objective third party is going to view the situation and going to view the arguments. And often it leads to a resolution of the dispute. Another example is mediation. Mediation, again, is not binding. Unlike an early neutral evaluation, it may not necessarily go into the details of legal arguments, but mediation also recognises that the position of both parties may not be certain, that there are risks on both sides, and a negotiated outcome is often a sensible outcome. So the idea that every dispute that you have with the tax office must necessarily result in court litigation is not the case.
I should ask a question tonight. Just before I do, can I bring to everybody's attention that this year the ATO published a booklet about what's called its compliance approach, which covers audits of small to medium enterprises and wealthy individuals. The booklet's of use because it sets out, first of all, how the commission will conduct such audits. So that's very useful information for a legal practitioner. But it also sets out what it expects from taxpayers in return. That's of even greater assistance to legal practitioners. It doesn't apply to the booklet doesn't apply to all taxpayers. As I said, it's only to a segment of them who are described as small to medium enterprises and wealthy individuals. Small to medium enterprises, I think, are economic groups that have a turnover between 2 million and 250 million, which I assume is per annum. Wealthy individuals and their economic groups with net wealth over $5 million. It's probably the first of those two groups, the small to medium enterprises, that most of us are likely to be concerned about. But that I'm now told that the booklet's no longer in existence, but it's available in electronic form on the on the ATO website. So I encourage everybody to have a look at that booklet to find out what it says. Can I now ask if there are any questions?
How do you go about actually engaging in that process?
Generally, you start by informing the tax office that that's an option you'd like to explore. There's then the process of agreeing on an evaluator. Then there's an agreement that is entered into by the taxpayer, the tax office, and the evaluator. And in that agreement, you'll set out things such as costs, timetables, because it's a process where parties exchange submissions and submissions go to the evaluator. So all of that is set out in an agreement. And sometimes there is actually a formal hearing. There is a hearing, so parties will have representation and present before the evaluator, and the evaluator will agree a date by which they will produce their evaluation.
Thank you.
By and large, the early neutral evaluation procedures is one that's adopted where what's between the parties is a dispute about the application to accepted facts. Where there are disputed facts, mediation is probably a better vehicle to use, but even in those circumstances, the neutral evaluation might be all right. Is that right? What's your experience in relation to this problem?
I agree with you that early neutral evaluation is not appropriate where there's factual disputes. I haven't been involved in an E&E where there has been factual disputes. It's been as Les has described. Yeah. And we have had a number of very successful E&E processes over the last 12 to 24 months. Mediation, as you say, is appropriate where there are facts in dispute, and mediations have become increasingly successful as well. the ATO is embracing ADR at all levels, audits, objections, litigation, and we're having great success with it. I think you'll find a lot of statistics in the recently published pamphlet called All Your Case Matters,
yes.
Which sets out a lot of details in relation to how we conduct litigation, statistics in relation to that. But yes, the ATO is embracing ADR and should always suggest if it's a viable option for your client.
Have there been, I don't think there's now any great difficulty in finding mediators or evaluators, is that there?
No, there's a whole range
to choose from.
We frequently, a lot of our, lot of taxpayers, particularly the larger ones, would prefer a judicial officer, a retired judge. Frequently they prefer retired High Court judges who seem to be actively engaged in ADR procedures. Personally, we find that the Federal Court Registrars are very effective and very well trained. It's my preference to use a trained mediator rather than a retired judge, because they have mediators have mediation skills which are essential for the resolution of a dispute.
Yes, I have heard that the success rate of the Federal Court mediators is outstanding.
It is outstanding, and yeah. We had a recent case in Perth where we had a federal court case, but there were proceedings in the AAT as well, and the registrar was very accommodating and had held the mediation involving the AAT and the federal court proceedings at the one time, and had a wonderful result from that. So they're very flexible in their approach, and are having great results.
There was just one topic that occurred to me when Keith was speaking before coffee, and that is what do you do if a dispute does arise between the taxpayer and the ATO about the provision of a document? Now, that dispute might arise in a couple of ways. It might be because the notice itself, the 264 notice, and it's too broad. Or it might be a dispute that arises because a dispute about privilege. If I could just ask Keith to comment upon the court procedures available where such disputes arise.
Well, where there's a dispute regarding the 264 notice, given that that's an administrative matter, one of the ways of challenging that in through the court processes would be, of course, review under the ADJR or Section 39B of the Judiciary Act to challenge the validity of the notice, at least in respect of demand for those documents. Of course, with LPP being a common law right, there's always the prospect of being able to challenge that or get a declaration regarding privilege attaching to the document through more common law channels, but the ADJR or the Judiciary Act would be the primary basis for taking that to court, is my understanding.
All right. Any more questions?
Can I ask a question from the back stool? You're not a tax practitioner, but in fact you're a clerk.
Yes,
but it used to be.
By all means.
It always interests me, and I'd like to hear, maybe Bill to start with, what attitude do you take if you go to mediation? I mean, people know how mediation seems to me to be about what attitude the parties take, and whether they come there with an open mind or a closed mind, and therefore, strategically, I'd be interested to hear how the panel members approach mediations.
If you're going to go to mediation as a taxpayer, it's an extremely costly procedure. You have to prepare, sometimes you may be asked or expected to prepare a position paper. You have to understand the case, and you have to have various options in mind as to how you want to settle it. Of course, you have a preferred position. You put that position, and if the commissioner rejects it, you got to go with the flow. But the way it works, that you put a position, and then you need to think of ways to accommodate them. Often where there are multiple entities involved in a dispute, there'll be a number of ideas of how to settle it. And sometimes all you need to do is to explain them to the particular representatives of the commissioner, and they might accept, for example, locating deductions in certain areas. As long as the position you take is open on the terms of the legislation, it would be something that the commissioner would consider, because that's a policy position. But yes, I would go to it, take it very seriously, because it's an extremely costly process, and you certainly would hope that you would produce a sound outcome.
And you would be open in the way you presented your case and take the risk that you might in fact be improving the commissioner's case if the mediation's unsuccessful?
Yes, I mean, whilst you could see that as a risk, the reality of it is this. If you have, for example, a new idea or a way of improving your case later on, it is always open for the commissioner to deal with it later. In other words, you're not going to gain a tactical advantage by deferring an argument to a later point, generally. So I don't mind putting the position in the hope that I'll bring the matter to conclusion and then everybody will be better off. So,
Michael, I was at a conference on the weekend and one of the members of the conference was Duncan Kerr, who's now a member of the Federal Court and president of the AAT. And he stated that when he went back into practice after politics, he did a number of mediations, I think working with Sir Lawrence Street. And their experience was that they had as much of a success rate with people who were at mediation with enthusiasm, that the success rate was as great with parties who had been compelled to attend mediation, which was quite an interesting observation to make.
I think it is important to go in with settlement options, not one option where you walk in and say, this is the way it is, take it or leave it, and change it to mold the position and hope to produce a good outcome. So you got to really understand the case and the options that are available and acceptable to the client.
Well done. I think that will do us. Can I thank you all for attending? It's very good of you. I hope we've given you some information. Can I thank the members of the panel and what I thought was very informative process, and particularly Keith, who put quite a bit of work into the presentation.